From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We're going forward full speed ahead on this vote recount, which is very important. And it also, you know, it also puts the Green Party on the map as the leadership that the American people are looking for.
That was the Green Party's 2016 presidential candidate, Dr. Jill Stein, speaking with RT America this past Friday about her demand for recounts in three states, the first of which was filed on Friday in Wisconsin.
In this extremely toxic and sick election, we're taking steps to actually redress some of the, really grave concerns about this election.
However, the recount effort is being conducted by Stein and her campaign, according to the campaign's website, and not the Green Party. There are reports from inside the Green Party's leadership that Stein proposed this to them last week, and it was voted down 5-3. For more on that, we spoke with our regular political commentator, Professor Anthony Montero, from Philadelphia via Skype Sunday.
It's so interesting that the neoliberals are organizing and managing this rolling coup. It is a tragic and sad outcome to see Jill Stein as a part of this dirty game of overturning what the electorate decided, playing by what are the rules of this game. Right. And of course, you know, the subtext is a new Cold War, new McCarthyism project that Donald Trump was elected because of Putin, the Russians hacking the computers and the DNC and John Podesta and others, and Julian Assange, who is, of course, in this narrative, an agent of Putin.
Right.
And up till recently, interestingly, Jill Stein was a part of the Putin-Assange project of thwarting and undermining American democracy. So, as we've said before, and you and I have discussed this over the months, that the election would not end with the election,
right.
No matter what the outcome was, it would continue. And now we have a full-scale, almost color revolution in play. You know, something we have not really talked about a great deal is that this might be, by this I mean the outcome of this election, might be the beginning of a project of taking down the neoliberal globalist throughout the Western world.
Right.
You know, the consequences of that are huge. It's not just the United States, it's the European Union, it's NATO, it's, well, the now almost forgotten TPP,
right.
You know, right. And so on. And, you know, with all of the contradictions of the Trump campaign, and they were multiple. I mean,
that's right.
It was a show that you could not have, if anyone would have told you that this would happen the way it did, you know, they would, you would be accused of writing fiction,
right.
Or even science fiction.
Right.
But now it looks like France is up for the same type of thing, following on the heels of Brexit and, of course, the 2015 Greek vote.
Yep.
Against the European Union.
Yep.
And we now are told that Angela Merkel in Germany is in big trouble from a similar type.
Yep.
Of movement.
Yep.
And you know, even though the corporate media are calling these far-right movements, These movements are really a synthesis of multiple forces based upon the working people and what in Europe they call the precariat, this large body of unemployed young people and other people who are living on the margins of the economy, irrespective of race or national origin or even citizenship status. This new configuration politically is threatening the now almost 35-year-old neoliberal project, the what we used to identify with Reagan in the United States and Thatcher in Great Britain. I mean, this is huge, and we're at the center of it here, and the election was at the center of it. I think you and I called it right. We saw what we saw,
yep.
And you know, we just stayed on point. And what has happened is a real takedown of the neoliberal managerial elite that have run this thing and run the world for almost 35 years, irrespective of party label.
Yep.
I mean, my God, the so-called socialist in France
right.
are part of this dirty arrangement,
yep.
as are the Democrats and the, quote, beautiful people, you know,
yep.
who are now condemning with a broad brush the entire working class as backward and racist yep. and homophobic and misogynist.
Yep.
Their behinds are now on the line, and we might be at the beginning of a new era, not just in the history of capitalism, but in world history,
yeah.
because the forces opposing this neoliberal elite objectively are not just the poor and working people, and in the case of this election, white working people and white poor people and the white lumpen proletariat, but their activity kind of merges with what is going on in the Philippines and Turkey and
right.
and everywhere else in the world.
Yep, Moldova.
So we're looking at a real transformation in the making.
Yep, and Moldova and Bulgaria. They had the elections also, and pro-Russian leadership was voted in each case.
Absolutely.
So, and then we had the case, I think it was the Sunday before Election Day here in the U.S., in Nicaragua, with Daniel Ortega drawing better than 70% of the vote. So much for the conservative restoration that they like to talk about in the New York Times. And, you know, a lot of forces gathering on the streets in Brazil and Argentina, where you may see working people take those countries back pretty quickly. And then, you know, just this happens in the context of all of that. And I'm really stuck on the thinking here that the only area of leverage that the Green Party has ever tried to exercise on a major stage, having renounced the power to deny Democrats the election that they were accused of in 2000 instead of claiming it, then a safe state strategy, so-called, in other words, go ahead, vote for Democrats in swing states in 2004, then the party abandoning Cynthia McKinney in 2008, and then the Jill Stein machine comes on the scene in 2010 with Ben Mansky and David Cobb from 2004 and Medea Benjamin as of late and others. It's now the big place that they can make a splash. By the way, gee, it puts Hillary Clinton in the White House, which is exactly what the elite wants to do. And $6 million so far comes in with it.
And you know, the disingenuousness of it is that they try to hide behind, well, we're doing this because we're interested in democratic and fair elections.
So why didn't they raise $6 million during the primaries, find some Democratic and independent voters who voted for Sanders to front for them, raise $6 million to litigate that so that you could overturn the primaries in California and a slew of other states where it was clearly stolen? Why didn't they do it then?
Or why haven't they raised that kind of money to build the state-by-state Green Party, right, to put them in a position to challenge for congressional and city council, mm-hmm, and and other elections building up to the 2020 election? Right. I mean, it's, you know, I think the sad thing is when we look at it in broad historical terms, Jill Stein and her group within the Green Party, which might not be the Green Party any longer, it, yeah, might just be her campaign.
Right.
And I think there's going to be a rebellion in the Green Party against this.
Yeah, it's already underway.
Yeah, it's underway. But, you know, what you're doing is not standing up for democracy. What you're doing is joining the camp of the war makers. And as such, as we know, war is the enemy of democracy.
That's right.
Forces that are now backing you, in fact, are celebrating Jill Stein. And only a couple of weeks ago, they were condemning her as standing in the way of a Clinton victory, and thus on the side of Trump. You know, and now they're praising her. I mean, this is, you just cannot miss what is happening here. And I'm certain that Jill and her people understand. Yeah. They have to understand.
They must understand.
And so the question is, why this betrayal?
I don't know. I mean, for me, first of all, the whole idea for those people that are involved in this effort and see it as this reformist effort that's going to somehow purify elections in the United States, you know, it ignores the entire context of the entire construct. They litigated the presidential debates thing. It didn't change anything. It's the only thing that this litigation is likely to change is the outcome of this election. It's not going to do away with machines that can't be audited and proprietary software and all of that. And even if it did, you still have the existing conditions in this country, which means it's going to be rigged one way or another. I mean, what's being rigged right now is being rigged through the courts and the Electoral College and the joint session for January 6th. All of those institutions will remain after this litigation. So what are they doing?
Well, see, I think you hit on a very important point because, you know, the strategy might not be what it appears to be. I think they might know that a recount would take us beyond December 19th. That's when the Electoral College meets.
Yep.
But I think they want to create a atmosphere where politically a number of electors will nullify the election by either abstaining,
right,
or shifting their votes.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So let us say 20 or more electors abstain.
Right.
And let us say another 5 change their votes.
Right.
You dig what I'm saying?
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be Clinton,
possible,
by the way.
The Electoral College, right, could then give the election on the basis of abstentions and shifting of votes to Hillary Clinton.
Yep. Or it goes to the House of Representatives, and the House could pick Clinton or, say, Biden or Warren, whoever the compromise candidate is, because so much dung has been heaped upon the outcome of the election that it's going to be widely acknowledged as having been unfair and stolen by Trump, and therefore whatever solution comes out of the process to rectify that, quote unquote, is going to be looked at as legitimate by a number of people. And so what they're doing is providing political cover for a soft coup.
Yeah, for a soft coup, which would include a kind of movement towards impeachment, you know, that reminds us of what's going on in Brazil.
That's right.
And, you know, it's so interesting, those who have made careers off of stealing elections, in particular the Clinton machine, are now claiming to be the victims of a stolen election.
Right.
You know? So, you know, the ironies are just abundant. They abound. And I am certain without a real effort to politically educate the people, the masses of people will be in a state of bewilderment,
yep,
not understanding what is happening. And of course, that creates a dangerous situation. And I'm thinking, especially given the tense situation in the world, for example, between the United States and Russia,
yeah,
or the United States and China, or in Syria. So it's a very, very dangerous situation, because there is, even though we talk about President Trump, President-elect Trump, there is really a vacuum of leadership at the executive level. And whether Trump is sworn in or not, he will find it more difficult to govern than even Obama did. I mean, his presidency is being deemed illegitimate, not just by Democrats, but by a broad swath of political forces now, which includes the left.
Yep. You've got a number of well, first of all, let's play that out. You have a situation where, you know, NATO, the U.S. is deployed basically to the borders of Russia and China with weapon systems hot and new ones coming in. And Russia seeing first the election and understanding it and reporting it and, you know, reaching out to Trump saying, OK, cool, you said we want to be friends, let's be friends. And Trump saying, yeah, let's be friends. And all of a sudden, maybe it doesn't look like it to the American people, but the Russians can see in reality when a coup d'etat happens and they know who the forces are that are managing it, even if Americans don't. And they realize that it may well mean war is coming to them any minute. So now when they look at reflections off the ground or, you know, some moonbeam behind a cloud or whatever and see it through their defense systems, who knows if they push a button, because they figure here it comes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're mourning the death of Comandante Fidel Castro at this moment, but we must be reminded now of the Cuban Missile Crisis and how close we came,
yep,
to nuclear war. And the weapons we have now are far larger and far more destructive and reach their targets much quicker than in 1962. I mean, we're in dangerous water. And, you know, Don, you and I have talked about this over the months, that the issue, the principal issue in this election is war and peace. I spoke, I think the weekend, yes, the Saturday before the election, here in Philadelphia at a rally, a Green Party rally, alongside of Chris Hedges, Jill Stein, Ajamu Baraka, and other local leaders. And, you know, I said there pretty much what we have been saying over the months, that the issue, the overriding issue, is the question of war and peace. And that Trump had made it absolutely clear over and over and over again that he was not interested in war, that he wanted detente, that he saw the enemy as ISIL and the Al-Nusra Front and those type of gangster forces, that he would unite with Russia, and by implication, the Assad government, that the world was better with Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, that he was against nation building and intervention in nations. What he was objectively saying, that he wanted to get back on the side of international law and bring the United States out of the realm of being a rogue pro-terrorist regime. We saw it that way. I spoke that way, you know, alongside of Jill Stein. And I invoked the words of W.E.B. Du Bois, who was indicted because of his anti-nuclear weapons position and activism in 1951. And there he said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called communists." Is that condemnation for the peacemaker or praise for the communist? I mean, you know, that in that in those beautiful, eloquent words, and I applied them to Jill and Ajamu. Blessed are Jill and Ajamu, you know, and I spoke from my heart. And I said to Jill, you know, after I finished, she was sitting beside me, and I said, "I meant every word of it, Jill." And she was very moved by what I had to say, and it seemed that we were on the same page. You know, I feel personally betrayed by this turn that she has made. I don't know how to explain it. It doesn't make sense. I mean, and there are a lot of things in this year that had not made a lot of sense.
Well, right in this, as a matter of fact.
The most recent one.
Right in this, as a matter of fact, because, you know, when I first saw it, I think yesterday morning, whenever it was, that they had actually filed, I went off the deep a little bit, and I posted something at Facebook. I assumed it was the Green Party, because the way it was presented was that was a natural assumption. And as it turns out, they took this project to the Green National Committee, or one of the executive committees of the party, and it was voted down. And the majority of the leadership said, "We don't want anything to do with this. This is going to elect Clinton. That's the point of it, and it's going to tarnish us." Mm-hmm. And yet, they went out with it. They announced it, okay, as the Green logo was on it, and it was Stein Baraka. And then I saw on Facebook that someone said that the Ajamu Baraka wasn't consulted and, you know, wasn't with it. So, you know, it seems like for the candidate of a party that relies on grassroots democracy, not only was I, as a Green registrant, not consulted on it, or apparently nor was anyone else, but when they consulted the leadership of the party, who, you know, represent the rest of us in one way or another, they said no. And yet they went ahead with it anyway, and they raised, you know, they're raising all this money and you know, making this big stink. They're all over CNN and New York Times and everywhere else, and lending legitimacy to the coup that is clearly underway.
That's right. That's right. And it's a coup not in behalf of democracy. It's the opposite.
Right. That's right.
And, you know, of course, the corporate media is playing a huge role. You know, the left, and we've, you know, over these months, Don, we've been very critical of the left, what goes for the left. And I think it's now very apparent that the left is being organized by the liberals and being mobilized by the liberals.
Yep.
I don't care whether it was the pop-up demonstrations after the elections or the marches that will occur going forward, you know, the Million Women's March or the Million March of Women, the march at the inauguration to shut down the inauguration. It appears to me that, and this is not unusual in modern human history, that the left becomes a tail to the liberals, and the liberals operating through non-governmental organizations and foundations and other vehicles are making it possible and encouraging the activity of, and you know, you really do have to put quotes around the word, the left.
Right.
This is a sad day.
Yeah. Let me just ask you something. I want to ask you something on this point. No, no. I want to ask you something on this point. because we're getting close to the end, and I want to get an answer to this for everyone, myself included. If you look through this, and let's say that they suddenly Trump isn't the president on January 20th, there's, you know, whatever, 47-48% of the electorate and a quarter of the population, or 20-30% of population, whatever, that is going to be very angry. And they're going to go into the streets, and it's going to be genuine. It's not going to be, AstroTurf grassroots activity. And the possibility exists of an intra-class war, basically, of a civil war being started. And those people, of course, are going to be painted as racist and, you know, Nazis and all of that. And coming through that, if we end up with an actual civil war or just so much unrest that there's a government crackdown, what does this left that thinks it's the left that's going to get through this have in terms of organization, in terms of the ability to govern, the mechanical, you know, wherewithal to govern, a program? They don't even have that, and class unity. Absent those things, this can only turn out to a repressive, overtly fascistic government to maintain order. Are they thinking it through to that far?
Well, obviously not. And, you know, when you listen to the ways that they talk and the concepts that they throw around, and especially they're attributing all things that are wrong with the politics of the country, they attribute that to the white working class, and by implication, working people in general. They think, and these are, you know, some very sophisticated scholars make this point, that it was a white lash. Right. That's pure and simple. No other explanation, no other information is necessary. And a white lash that is the fault of the white poor and working class. You know, it appears to me that for the first time in decades, a majority of white working people voted more or less for their class interests.
Yep.
You know, there had been a discourse going back to the 1980s. Thomas Frank wrote the book, What Happened in Kansas. And what he argued is that with the election of Reagan, the working class, the white working class, was set on a path of voting against its class interests. You know, I wouldn't argue with that. Of course, there was no serious leadership to define what their class interest was.
And there was no alternative offered. I mean, Carter wasn't offering them a solution either.
That's right. No question. So now they vote closer to their class interest. And by that, I mean, vote for a candidate that's against war and against the neoliberal architecture of trade and so on and so forth. Right. They voted closer to their class interests than they have in decades. Right. But the game is not over because of one election. It is what happens going forward.
That's
how
right.
the working class and the working people and the poor come together in this new moment of challenge. And this is what is before us. The left, what we call the left, which is really a group of small organizations that proceed from an infantile and childish understanding of revolutionary processes. They really are not. They can't play a role in this. They're mainly middle class and petty bourgeoisie. And, you know, they talk a lot, but on the ground, they're very ineffective. If we go to what you're suggesting, most of what we call the left will run for the hills because they don't know how to handle this kind of situation.
Professor Montero, thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.